This is The Guardian.
Hi, Laura Murphy Oates here. Before we start Full Story for 2022, we're revisiting some of our best episodes of the past year. This episode, which originally aired in last January, takes you inside Australia's juvenile justice system to document one story, that of Dungati man Isaiah. Isaiah's story, and really the whole project, which was called Childhood in Custody, really brought home for me the fact that Australia jails kids, particularly Indigenous kids, far too much and far too young. Isaiah's story in particular is a really rare insight into what this system looks like from the inside, but also the power of community-led justice systems. Okay, here it is. Across Australia, more than half of the kids in juvenile custody are Indigenous. And in some detention centres, every single child inside is Indigenous. Some of them only 10 years old. Over the past few months, I've been trying to find out why so many Indigenous kids are caught in the juvenile justice system. To do that, I've been speaking to people who have either lived or worked inside it and asking them what they think needs to change. On yesterday's episode, you heard from Thira, a parent trying to save his kids from the police brutality and institutional control he experienced as a young man. In this episode, you'll hear from Isaiah.
There's more to life. There's a lot more opportunities than men getting told when to eat, when to shit, when to shower, when getting told when to wake up, when to go to sleep, when your TV can get turned off, you know what I mean? There's way more than to do to life than to be behind them fucking doors.
Today, Isaiah's journey through the juvenile justice system. It's Friday, the 22nd of January.
Testing.
So, Ellen, you are in the driver's seat today. You are the interviewer for this episode.
That's right. The tables have turned again.
Ellen Lee Beater is an audio producer at Guardian Australia.
Hey, fam. Someone's showing the line.
Can you tell us where we are and what tonight is?
We are at St. Mary's Kingsway. It's Oz Tag Night. So, yeah, every Thursday we come down and have a run. Yeah.
So my first question is, why are we at an Oztag game in Western Sydney?
Well, I was there because of Isaiah.
Isaiah signs 23 and I'm from Kempsey, yeah. Dungati tribe, yeah. Mm. But I live in Mount Druitt, yeah.
And did you grow up around here as well?
No, I grew up in Mountie.
Mm. And what's your role in the team?
I'm like captain / team organiser /
Boys from Melia, they don't have a captain.
They all like to think they're captains.
But it's a big game tonight.
Yeah, it's a semi, so yeah, hopefully we win this to get in the grand final.
Yeah. Do you reckon the team's got what it takes?
100%. 100%. We just got to be fitter. Shit.
Again and again, boys. Stay wide.
So tell us about this Oztag team.
It's an all-Indigenous men's team called the Native Sons. Everyone is in their teens to early 20s, and they all grew up together in Mount Druitt in Western Sydney. For Isaiah, these boys are his friends, and he even considers them like family.
Most of us aren't even related. Like, most of us, we call each other cousins by choice, or we call each other brothers by choice.
They all grew up knowing each other around Mount Druitt, and some of them didn't have a lot of strong supports. You know, for example, Isaiah was in care growing up.
No, that's all it was just enjoying each other. Like, most of us come from a broken family, so we just love having, you know, that family relationship with the brothers.
I came to this Oztag game because Isaiah, along with many on the team, have a lot to say about how our justice system treats young Indigenous kids.
Play backyard footy, boys.
Oh, that's the way.
Did you hear Alcaz out there? He was swearing at his own teammates because they're shit. He knows they're shit. No one wants to push him. They lost the ball. They're shit. Look at him sitting there by himself.
So that night, everyone was pretty excited and focused on the game. But just a few years back, doing something like this, playing Oztag, was actually kind of hard for these boys.
What do you mean by that?
Isaiah says that growing up, when he and his mates would get together to hang out and kick a footy, police were never too far behind.
When we were younger, we used to play footy in the park and that, but we used to get move along directions, so...
When you say moved along, what would happen?
If cops see us having too much fun, or I don't know, because like, everyone loves football. Like as soon as we like, if it was like safe, it was like three or four of us down there playing, it always turned into about 20, like big games of football, and then cops have to come down and be the party poopers.
It's not something you like to think is very commonplace in Australia, but Isaiah says that it happened all the time, so much so that they found it hard to just go and hang out and kind of get some exercise after school. But it wasn't just when they were playing sport. Many on the team actually have spent a lot of their young lives in contact with police.
Like, I don't remember much from my childhood, but that's the thing, I do remember them chasing my brothers. So, yeah.
For example, Isaiah says that often he would be stopped just for hanging out in a group walking on the street. If there were more than about two boys together, officers would stop them and even sometimes search them.
It was mainly when we were in groups to two to three boys. It happened a lot. Yeah, we couldn't even walk to our local shop.
He remembers one time when he was 13. He was heading to the local shopping centre with a group of friends. It was Thursday night, so as you do, he was heading to late night shopping, when he was actually stopped by the police on a busy road.
I just happened to be, me and my cousin happened to be pulled out of the group. And me and my cousin happened to be the only black kids out of them. So, yeah,
How many kids were there in that group?
13 of us.
And the two black kids?
Yeah.
Isaiah says the police told them to take their clothes off and they were searched.
When I was 13, I got shipped down to Mundy's, yeah.
Did they give you any reason?
Suspicious, large group. Oh, yeah.
And where did that happen? Like, where did they go? Did you get any privacy?
No, it just happened on the main road. It happened in our spot.
Oh, my God. How many cops were there at that moment?
At first, it was three jumped out of the car, but by the end of it, it was like, 15 to 16 coppers. Yeah.
How did that feel at that moment? Had anything like that happened to you before?
Nah, like, it was embarrassing, but, like, yeah, so, like, I didn't know what to do, so I just, yeah.
Have you heard of other kids being strip searched in that way on the street?
Oh, I got plenty of stories. We'll be here all day.
So why were these boys always getting pulled up?
It's hard to say for sure, but, you know, there is quite a bit of evidence to say that Indigenous kids are over-policed in Australia. In New South Wales in particular, there are some programs and pieces of legislation that have contributed to Indigenous kids being picked up by the police more. One of them is the consorting laws, where it's an offence for a person 14 or older to consort with convicted offenders after being warned not to by police. Those laws were introduced in 2012 as a big crackdown on bikie gangs, but there was a review by the New South Wales Ombudsman in 2016 that found really they were being used way too much just to target young Indigenous people.
Yeah, I don't know if we're targeted, but it happened to us quite a lot when we were younger. Like, I remember one time we got stopped, strip searched once, and 5 to 10 metres up the road, we got stopped again and asked questions, but they didn't strip search us. They just jumped down and asked us more questions by the same coppers, but it's just because they, yeah.
The same cops pulled you over just 10 metres later?
Yeah, because we had more boys with us. And like I said, because if the coppers in Mount Jordan know you are, or you're known to them, you become a target. So.
Okay, but were these kids actually committing any offences?
It's possible that some were, but Isaiah told me that they were just young kids who were hanging out.
Yeah, it's like it was like we didn't like spend the afternoon playing like to get in trouble or anything. We're just trouble always found us.
What does that do to a young kid living under these oppressive conditions?
Isaiah told me it got to the point where if they were stopped by police, they were scared. They were worried that they would be searched or arrested, so they would just run.
Do you feel like some of these interactions are really charged from the get-go? What's it like when police start talking to you?
I don't know. Like, if they're pulling you over, especially, like, in our cases, we knew they were pulling us over just to get a reaction out of us. So we knew as soon as they pull up, it's either we all run so no one get caught, or we know if we stand there, someone's getting arrested and it's going to be an ugly situation. That's how it always will be and always was, I mean. So.
Did you have any interactions with police that were not like that, where you felt like they were trying to look out for you?
Nah, not one. Nah, honestly, nah, not one. Straight up, yeah.
Eventually, these interactions with police got more and more serious. And as Isaiah got older, he started committing offences and ending up in youth detention. And then at 16, he committed some more serious offences, which we won't be going into as he was still a child at the time. But he was sent to youth detention and spent the next 3 years in and out of custody.
What can you tell us about Isaiah's time in detention?
Overall, he moved around to a bunch of different detention centres.
How many of the boys that were in detention throughout all your different times, how many of them were Indigenous, do you think?
A lot.
At one point, he ends up at Cobham Juvenile Justice Centre. It's on the outskirts of Sydney, not far from Mount Druitt, really.
Straight out, half my neighbourhood and half my childhood, people I've met and used to run around with. At one stage, there was like 40 of us.
And like many other kids in detention, Isaiah was actually in there for a while without being convicted of anything. It's called being on remand.
Why would a kid be put in detention when they haven't been convicted of anything yet?
It's actually pretty common. More than half of all kids in detention are unsentenced. They haven't been convicted of anything. And there's a few reasons that might happen. When you've committed a quite serious offence, the court can decide that you're a danger to the community while you wait for your trial date, and you won't get bail and be able to go back to the community and wait for that court date. But we're also talking about kids here who are pretty vulnerable. About a third of kids who have come into contact with the justice system in the past 5 years have been flagged by Child Protection as kids who have been abused or neglected. So pretty often it could be that they just don't have a safe place to go and they're funneled into the youth detention centre while they wait for their court date.
What was it like for Isaiah in detention?
Early on, things do not go well for Isaiah. After about 6 months inside in 2015, he was placed in the Chisholm Behaviour Program. At the time, this was a new program that was run out of two detention centres, one on the Central Coast and also at Cobham Juvenile Justice Centre in Western Sydney, which is where Isaiah was. This Chisholm program was for young people who were considered high risk, basically people they thought needed to be separated from the rest of the detention population. And throughout the life of this program, 66 young people, most of them Aboriginal, were subject to some fairly shocking conditions.
I was the first one off the bus and there was like a line of officers with shields, helmets.
Isaiah says that he was greeted by officers with shields and helmets and his time there was really tough. He was kept in a tiny cell with a see-through door, constantly surveilled by cameras. Most of the time, if he wanted to just use the toilet or brush his teeth, he had to buzz for a guard.
We weren't allowed cutlery, we weren't allowed to change our clothes, we weren't allowed toilet paper. The space wasn't even bigger than this. And we had to come out with handcuffs on. And I'll take 5 steps that way, I'll touch the wall. Take 5 steps back this way, I'll touch the wall. And we still had to come out with handcuffs on.
people working in this system would call this program a supermax for kids. That's how they referred to it. And in 2018, a report by the New South Wales Inspector of Custodial Services, which is this independent role that oversees how, you know, detention centres are run and managed, it found that young people in this program were kept in isolation for 22 hours a day for weeks at a time.
What do you even fill your time with? How does it feel sitting there during the day?
Sleep.
And Isaiah says there really wasn't much to do.
If you can't sleep, you just have to train. If you don't, most of the boys just go crazy. A couple of boys did go crazy, like, went mad. I'm not, like, crazy, just started talking to themselves and shit, like, yeah.
I should probably point out that the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which Australia has signed up to, prohibits torture or other cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment of children. And the UN says that solitary confinement fits that description.
This was 5 years ago now. Are kids and young people still being held in isolation like that? Have we moved on?
I would like to say that we have. I mean, in Chisholm, that program no longer exists. In 2016, Youth Justice New South Wales was forced to close the program down following legal complaints about the extensive isolation of boys. But the use of isolation has happened and may still be happening in other states. One of the other stories in this project details allegations of extensive isolation of kids in WA. This issue was also raised in the Northern Territory Royal Commission into Youth Detention. Around this time, when Isaiah is in this Chisholm program, his fortunes begin to change.
Yeah, like if it was for Dan, like I wouldn't be in the position I am today, yeah.
Next, Isaiah meets Daniel Daylight.
Who's Daniel?
Daniel is a 33-year-old Gamilaroi man, and he helped Isaiah and the others get the Oztag team going in the first place. He helps out with training and he turns up to every game.
Hey, Daniel. Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
How are the guys going?
Yeah, all right.
You
it's a draw.
Score.
It's a draw. It's a draw.
Ever since Daniel was a teenager himself, he has worked within or alongside the justice system, supporting young Indigenous people. He says he got into this because of his own experiences growing up in Western Sydney.
I had more cousins in jail than other people had cousins. That's just the way it always was for us.
And what sorts of things was Daniel doing in the justice system?
Well, he started out working as an Aboriginal support officer in the Parramatta Children's Court in Western Sydney. Daniel's job involved referring kids to things like housing and mental health services. And he said it was pretty confronting.
So you sit in a court and you refer people on to things. You know, you make that referral and then you say, well, why does this fella keep coming in? Or they get referred to youth justice and then you're like, well, then why are they still homeless? And then you very quickly realise that the system is just not working.
In Australia, the age of criminal responsibility is 10. So some of the kids coming through are really, really young. And Daniel says that for these very young kids, a lot of them were Indigenous and many of them were in care.
I can remember being there, a young person applying for bail so he could go to his year six farewell. You know, I've seen a lot of kids that don't even look 10 come through the court, you know. But the way I always saw it was like those, if you were a 10-year-old, 10, 11 to 12, 13, in that age range, coming for the children's court and coming quite often, it was just because you have no support. And you've got a lot of issues, but, like, you know, we're criminalising them.
Daniel says that after a while, he just saw the same kids cycling through the courts time and time again. They were kind of stuck in this horrifying loop.
I realised that we needed to do something different, because I was just watching 14-year-olds that I knew go into adult custody. I was watching 10-year-olds I know just languishing in juvenile custody. But, like, fuck, we're not doing anything to change the trajectory for these young people. So we needed to try something different.
Daniel was really frustrated with how this system was working, and he wasn't the only one. Eventually, he and the magistrate of the Children's Court, plus a bunch of other people from the community and the justice system, got together to try and figure out a solution. And in 2015, they launched this program for Indigenous kids called the Koori Court.
What is the Koori Court, and how is it different from Children's Court?
So it's pretty different. In a regular children's court, when you plead guilty or are found guilty, you have a sentencing hearing where the magistrate would decide what punishment is appropriate. However, Indigenous kids can be sent to the Koori Court at that moment. And that hearing is very, very different from a regular sentencing hearing. Firstly, Indigenous elders from the community are brought in, along with the Indigenous support person like Daniel, and everyone, including the magistrate, sits on the same level in a circle, just like you were having a chat. Daniel told me he got a bunch of artworks from Indigenous kids in detention from around the state and hung them up in the room just to make it feel a little bit less intimidating for the kids who were coming to court. In that meeting, instead of just getting a sentence, they go around the circle and they talk with the young person about why they committed the offence in the first place.
It's like that would be a bit different to a normal courtroom, right, where you expect to have a lawyer standing up and talking on your behalf to the court, right? Like sometimes it's very rare that the actual person who's in trouble gets to talk and share their story.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound that groundbreaking, but I spoke to some young people for this project who say that they were in and out of court for their whole teen years, and at no point did anyone just ask them what was going on with them or how they felt. They never really got a chance to explain what they were going through and what brought them to court in the first place.
All along the way, there was points without asking for help, but the services were not in any way prepared to be able to work with challenging kids.
And this is where Isaiah and Daniel cross paths. Isaiah came to the Koori Court on an offence committed in youth detention.
I had a chip on my shoulder. I didn't give a fuck. I didn't care about nothing. And all I remember was seeing a big bowl of chocolate on the table. And I walked in and then they had my attention, like, fucking. I was like, yep, boom, I sat there and I just smashed a whole bowl. Like, I think it was only like one or two bowls, like chocolate slab.
He told me that he could see how different it was straight away.
First thing I said when I opened the door, I was like, holy shit. And I was like, oh, look at all the black fellas. Yeah. Right, yeah.
He was just smiling and laughing, and it was just a really good thing, even though it was quite heavy, you know.
I just liked it better than like a normal court, because everyone sat around the table, showing up on a big chair, looking down at you, like thinking she's all high and mighty. I mean, when she's actually just a normal, regular Joe like us, you know? Like, so, yeah, so I was like, that's what made it more comfortable.
So at this meeting, the whole group creates a 12-month plan to tackle the kind of underlying issues behind what brought this kid to court in the first place. Maybe they were homeless and they need a home. That group then meets, you know, once a month to see if this plan is working.
So instead of reducing their recidivism rates, we're reducing the risk factors that lead to them reoffending.
And what are some of those risk factors that were common?
Like homelessness, drug use, anger management issues, physical, emotional, spiritual health, being disconnected from their culture. There's a wide, like, so many different issues, and we were just trying to tailor each kind of action and support plan to that client. So like really trying to get a bit creative and make it a bit more individualized than just be like, you're sentenced, go and see juvenile justice.
And at the end, the kid is still sentenced, but it may be that the court decides that they've kind of served their time by being involved in the Karoo Court in the first place, or there's less need for them to meet up with youth justice, or, you know, they'll have a shorter sentence or something like that. The whole idea is just to divert these kids away from the youth justice system.
And in Isaiah's case, what did Daniel and the Koori Court do for him?
So they met once a month and tried to figure out things like a leaving care plan. Isaiah was going to be too old for the care system when he got out, so he needed to figure out where he would live and what he would do. So Koori Court started to link him up with some of the services that he would need. But at the end of the 12 months, one of the big things that came out of all this for Isaiah was his relationship with Daniel. Isaiah still had a few more years on his sentence, and Daniel started calling him and visiting him all the time.
But yeah, but Dan helped me with a lot. So like he, when I was in custody, he got me undies, socks, clothes. He brought my cousins up to see me. Like, oh, Dan, fuck, I don't know, I lost count how many times Daniel visited me.
Daniel also did this with a few of the kids he met in Koori Court. He says it's because he knew that they didn't really have anyone to look out for them.
I didn't really get much visitors. I didn't really ring anyone. So and the whole time I was there, I got free visits from family.
We just need to help people who need help. Like that's all we need to do at the end of the day. Like the biggest problem with the whole system is there's no caring.
And near the end of Isaiah's sentence, when he was starting to be allowed out in the community more and more for day visits to prepare himself for life after jail, Daniel would pick him up and take him to see his family. Alongside youth justice workers, they also organised for him to get his driver's licence and figured out where he would live when he left youth detention.
Yeah. How did that feel getting out?
It was different. To be honest, I wouldn't even thought I'd last 2 days a day. And I got Dan and a lot of people to thank for that.
Even with all of this support that he did have, which many kids don't get, he assumed that he wouldn't be out for long. He figured he'd be straight back in pretty much.
So why was Isaiah so pessimistic about this?
To be fair, he kind of has a good reason to be pessimistic. Many kids who go into youth detention do end up serving more time. In 2018, according to a report by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, 61% of kids released from detention returned within 6 months and 80% within 12 months. And the rate of return for Indigenous kids is generally even higher than non-Indigenous kids.
Some cases, they just set them up to fail, like straight the fuck out. Like, I've seen boys do 9-10 years and then within my time, I've seen boys getting out, you know, from doing lagging, like, I mean, monstrous lagging from young ages, and they're getting released. Open the door and let them go back into the community.
Is there any support?
No case plan in place, no community help, no. All they got is just release the kids back to their family and that's it.
What happened to Isaiah when he got out? Did he end up back in detention?
No. He managed to get out and stay out. Right now, it's been 3 years since Isaiah was released. And in that time, he started a family. He has two young boys. He also started working at Just Reinvest, which is a not-for-profit organisation focused on addressing the over-representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in custody. Daniel is on the executive committee there, and Isaiah is a youth engagement officer. So he's been doing some on-the-ground work in Western Sydney and also some broader advocacy work. Daniel says that he's really given some of the boys that are still inside in detention a bit of hope.
They're all proud of him, you know what I mean? And so I always try and pass that on to him, you know? Like, he's like, for them, he's that fellow who stayed out, you know? And so he's that hope for this fellow when he gets out, you know, in a couple of years.
Last year, Isaiah received an award as New South Wales Emerging Youth Worker of the Year from Youth Action.
What sort of work has he been doing?
So he started a program with Just Reinvest called Mountie Yarns, where he and some of the other youth ambassadors talk to young people in Mount Druitt and Western Sydney about over-policing, about youth detention, and the effects that it can have on their mental health. They're hoping to use that report and kind of advocate on behalf of some of these kids. He also goes into youth justice centres and shares his story with young people inside. And he was also able to get the Oztag team going.
Tell me a little bit more about how that came about.
So Isaiah and Daniel partnered up with the Western Sydney Community Legal Centre. They found some leftover money in their budget to try and fund the uniforms and the entry fees for a bunch of kids in Mount Druitt. Jess Brown, who's a youth worker from the centre who already knows a lot of the boys through working with them in community, picks up everyone and takes them to training and also to their games. And at the games, you have youth workers and community members on the sidelines cheering along, but also they're there to liaise with police if they try to stop them or interfere with what's supposed to be just a fun and happy time.
Slow it. I mean, we've got a lot of boys off the streets and a lot of young fellas come down and the opportunity to be a part of something, be a part of a team, yeah, be part of a family, which some of them don't have the opportunity to have, yeah.
Sorry, Isaiah, can you tell us what just happened?
Oh, we won.
Shake the hands.
What is it about Oztag that has become such a good solution?
Well, this was Isaiah's idea, and he knows this community better than anyone else. I spoke earlier about kids getting picked up at late night shopping on Thursdays by the police. He lived that and he knows that kids need something on that night to do. Isaiah also knows these young fellas really well. He knows that most of them would never turn up to some community centre asking for help, but they will turn up to a footy game.
Take them out now, but you get them a footy and you get them playing the footy together, you're going to hear nothing but laughing. Fucking, there's that much shit talking, like, and it's good too. It's like back and forth, and it's just like be a part of something, I suppose, and makes them feel included, you know. Like, but for us, like, it's just a fun thing, and like I said, like, you can get them drinking, and they won't have as much fun as when they're all together, when all the brothers are together playing. Like, even from a young age, when we played footy, and it's like you can see the competitive comment. Oh, I mean the shit, yeah. But it's something we love doing, and now that we're all old enough and we're all roughly around the same age that we all can do it together, fuck, that's the best thing anyone can do, you know? Like,
well, I think the whole issue really just comes down to back to self-determination and community control. Like, our people know what the answers are. They've known for a long time.
So it sounds like Isaiah and Daniel are working hard to change things in their community and in the court system in Western Sydney. But what about more broadly? What about youth detention as a whole?
So they're actually part of a campaign that wants to radically change youth detention as we know it. It's called Raise the Age, and it's pushing for Australia to raise the age of criminal responsibility to 14 so that, you know, we don't have 10 to 13-year-olds stuck in the court, stuck in youth detention unnecessarily.
Do you think that 10 to 13-year-olds in Australia should be in youth detention, should be in jail?
Nah. Because they're kids. Kids will be kids. Like, I know it's that's like a big thing to say, but fuck, they're 10 to 13, they're just mature and they're...
Do you think that some of the really young fellas that you met knew right from wrong?
Fuck, no way. They didn't even know how to fucking spell their name right. Like, they, you know, like they struggled to fucking, to, you know, read the time. Like, they struggled to, like, I mean, like, write their last name. Like, that's fucking young. Like, you know what I mean? Like, no way.
Youth detention is supposed to reduce crime, to stop people from committing crimes and being out on the street. Do you think that that is that's working?
Bullshit. That's the most bullshittest thing like, the government has ever said.
Australia is actually pretty far behind the international community on this issue. The average age of criminal responsibility worldwide is 14, and obviously 10 is much lower. I've been speaking to a lot of people who work in different roles in the juvenile justice system, people like police, magistrates, lawyers, and they said that, yes, there are a lot of very important things that need to change in this system, but nearly all of them supported raising the age. Some said that this would just make an enormous impact right away, both to the well-being of kids and to the broader community. There's also a cost argument. You know, it costs around $1,400 a day to keep a child in youth detention. Ultimately, Daniel believes that if we invest this money into kids like Isaiah, while they're in the community, while they're young, everyone would be a lot better off, especially young Indigenous kids.
Are we really that scared of 10-year-old kids that we want to lock them up? Like, do we really have that much to fear of a 12-year-old Aboriginal kid in Mount Druitt, in Redfern, in Bourke, in Moray, that we need to cage them away from their family and away from their community? Or do we need to take a good hard look at ourselves and realise that that 12-year-old kid did not get there by themselves? Like, they were pushed onto that path by circumstances that they had no control over. They were born into a family, they are born into a family that suffered for generations upon generations in this country. So I think things like raising the age, it's the very basic things that we need to do. The fact that we still need to argue to not lock up a 13-year-old kid is kind of ridiculous to me, and it shows how far we have to go. Because if I need to convince you that you need to care about the well-being of a 13-year-old kid, Aboriginal or not Aboriginal, then if I'm having that conversation with you, it's like there's no point in it. You know what I mean? Like, that should be the bare minimum.
That's it for today. Big thanks to Isaiah and Daniel for sharing their stories. Since recording this episode, in November last year, Australia's Attorneys General announced they will look at raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 12 years old, a move that some advocates say does not go far enough. This episode was part of the Childhood in Custody Project, supported by the Barlow Foundation. You can check out the full multimedia project at theguardian.com, including Isaiah's article, which we've also linked on the Full Story page. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert, Ellen Leibeater, and Joe Koning. Additional production on our whole Best Of series was by Beth Atkinson-Quinton. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you next time.